The views and opinions expressed by A Little Bit Culty are those of the hosts and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the podcast. Any content provided by our guests, bloggers, sponsors, or authors are of their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, group, club, organization, business individual, anyone, or anything. Hey everyone, I'm Sarah Edmondson.
Hi, I'm Anthony Ames, Sarah's husband, aka Nippy.
And we're here to talk about things that are just a little bit culty. We were in a cult and we woke up, and it was all captured in a docuseries called The Vow on HBO, also in my memoir, Scarred.
And then we made this podcast. I guess you could say we're technically a cult show now.
But not your typical cult show. We're not so much about the grisly details. We are about kicking the doors down on the shame and the secrets that make these culty things so destructive.
We're here to have frank conversations about how cool things can cross over into the cultiverse. How to spot trouble when you see it, and what happens when it comes to recovering from something culty, if that happens to you.
Each week, we'll call on experts, advocates, fellow survivors, and whistleblowers to help us unpack what's going on in the cultiverse.
We're here to share what we know on everything from red flags to resiliency, and to have a few laughs along the way, because sometimes you gotta laugh.
Thank God. Now, we have a lot to cover, so let's get this show rolling, shall we? A Little Bit Culty Season 2 drops new episodes every Monday on the Acast app or wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And to learn more, visit us on Instagram or at alittlebitculty.com. Hey, Nip.
Hello, Sarah.
How are you?
Pretty good. Pretty good. Pretty good. Why don't we always start with our NPR voice?
I think it's because I've always wanted to be on NPR, putting it out there to the universe.
They hear you loud and clear, Sarah.
So this timeline's way off because we're recording so far in advance. But in our reality of time, the Bolts Weber just dropped, and there's been such positive feedback from our interview with her.
Yeah, she's fun.
She's so fun. And I'm also really happy because we haven't been canceled yet, which I guess could happen any moment.
I already canceled you on Twitter.
You canceled me on Twitter, yeah. But also a number of people who wrote to me said that they do identify with the Liberal Party and they didn't feel like we should be canceled. So that's good. Although I haven't heard from any limousine liberals who might be canceling us right now.
Limousine liberals don't know that they're limousine liberals.
Oh, that's true.
That's what makes them limousine liberals.
Yeah, we did get some feedback, and this has been a conversation from day one of our podcast, was what do we call us survivors? Somebody suggested victors. What do you think?
We asked that question almost a year ago.
I know, but people are catching up. Not everyone's on the same page. They're just listening to our pod now. There's a lot to catch up on. Anyway, you don't have to answer now. I don't want to put you on the spot. No.
Taking this to a pumping iron theme.
No.
All right.
No. Okay, here's a letter that came through. We don't normally read letters from our listeners, but this one just made me really happy. Just finished your book. I can't imagine how scary getting out must have been. Yeah, it was scary. I've been interested in learning about high control organizations and the impact they have on individuals for over a decade. I first became interested by following the FLDS, and from there began to dive into other cults. It was Mike Rinder and Leah Remini's work that made me realize how guarded these organizations can be by laws and other policies. But after listening to their podcast, your podcast, and now your book, I've decided to apply to a graduate school and pursue a degree in public affairs with the intention to work for a nonprofit that helps change laws and policies that protect these cult organizations / leaders, and also provides transitional services and resources to survivors. Thank you for continuing to do the work. And that just makes me so happy. How great.
I didn't know anything about that.
I know. I saved it for this.
Oh, look at you.
And the person who wrote this will know who they are if they hear this. Please connect with us once you do that, because, you know, one of the things I really feel passionate about, and it's true, when people get out of these groups, they're so dependent on the group often for their livelihood mm-hmm. and everything that they don't have any resources to get therapy and move on with their lives. So that's really important.
Yeah, super changing lucky the laws. In that way. Didn't we?
Yes. Yeah, we were super lucky. So whoever wrote this, definitely connect with Mike and Leah, because their situation with Scientology is very different than ours, and they're fighting a much bigger battle. But our guest today, check out this segue, is like the opposite in terms of the battle that she has to fight, because
you can't pump your own tires in your own segue.
I just did.
I know. It doesn't feel right.
All right. I'll stop pumping my own tires with my segue. But
I can go. That was a great segue.
Okay. All right. Let's try this again. So our guest, however, is the opposite.
Nice segue.
Thanks, babe. Jurette Bouillon. I hope I'm saying her name right. Jurette has actually become a friend in this whole post-cult space. And her group is, you know, the opposite of Scientology. You've never heard of it. You'll never hear of it. And she wrote a book about it. And she doesn't name the guy or the actual group. She was actually a member of an under-the-radar cult for over 18 years. In this organization, there was no tithing, no rules about where you should live, what brand of deodorant you must use, or what clothes to wear. Instead, far more subtle techniques were used, but they were powerful and destructive all the same. When Jurette finally emerged from the cult at age 52, she asked herself, how did I, an educated, caring mother, wife, and business owner, become that lost and for that long?
Her book, An Everyday Cult, is a page-turning memoir that details her path from hopeful therapy client to enthusiastic cult member to an anti-cult crusader. It also just might be a wake-up call if you think you're too smart for a cult.
In October 2020, Jurette's dream of launching a hashtag MeToo-style movement for cult survivors shifted into reality when she collaborated with others to co-found the hashtag IGotOut movement and IGotOut.org.
She joins us today to share her story and to discuss how undue influence can poison what starts out as a good thing and turn it into a culty shit show.
Without further ado, Jurette Bouillon. Welcome to A Little Bit Culty.
Welcome, Jurette.
I'm so glad to be here.
We've been talking about this for a while, and I feel like it's just the perfect timing with what's happening in the world and your book coming out. We just wanted to, again, say how much we loved your book. And when you asked me to write the foreword for your book, the first paragraph that I want to read to you, because I think it's a good segue into this conversation and where we are now, which is from the foreword of your book, we are obsessed with cults. This is the zeitgeist of our current culture. We want to know how on earth people get sucked in. Why do they stay? What wakes them up? For better or worse, it's the sensational cults that grab the headlines. Group suicides, sex scandals, branding, starvation diets, and mass deception. But what about the less obvious groups? The family groups, the organizations, the political groups, or the manipulative partners who gaslight you? What about the everyday cults? How do they work? We wouldn't understand such dynamics if people didn't speak up about their experiences with these groups. Jurette Bouillon is one of those brave warriors who courageously share their journey with us. So leaving it there, and anyone can pick up your book and finish the rest on their own time. But I wanted to start there by saying that I think it's so important that you didn't just go off and hide under a rock like most people do when they wake up from such things. And you decided to become an educator and to help shine light on these abuses to help them, which is where we met in the cult recovery world.
Exactly.
Yeah. So here we are. And short of people reading your book, which I really do recommend, I would love to hear your story. And as you know from our podcast, generally our format is for survivors like yourself. How did you get in? How did you get out? And how are you healing? But your book maps out those stages with different terms and different words. So I was hoping that you could tell us an abridged version of what drew you in and what are the terms that you used in your book that are same meaning but different words. We'll ask questions along the way.
Sounds great. Well, thank you for that, Sarah. Thanks for the introduction. I love that opening paragraph that you wrote. It's thrilling to hear it, I have to say. So, you know, for me, the first part of falling into the cult was that word falling. Mm. And I equate falling with both falling in love and falling asleep. We talk about love bombing in a cult, those early stages where everything is just hunky-dory and you've got these people that you see, you're doing beautiful things. I saw people in my life changing and growing and have this kind of glow in their eyes. And I wanted some of that action. And, you know, I actually had to wait a little bit because I was pregnant, you know, when I witnessed my first friends going in. So I had like delayed gratification. I felt like I really wanted to wait until after my daughter was born. And I did that. She was about 6 months old when I started. And yeah, I did a lot of falling from there. So both falling in love, I wasn't at all aware of the fact that I was also falling asleep. And just before you fall asleep, there's this kind of mind trippy experience, what I call drifting, which is where time and space kind of warp and life becomes a little bit weirder. And that was my experience as I was getting deeper into the cult, is what I call drifting. And that is when I felt like I was kind of becoming unhinged in a way. And yet I was still like in the world in a way. Yeah, too much was going on. I was giving up too much of myself.
The stages in sequence were what? Remind me.
Falling, drifting, then asleep.
Right. Okay. The sleep one was the one I was particularly interested in when I was reading about it. It's one of the things, the thoughts I had when I was reading it, is I bet you could make a case that people who aren't involved with cults kind of have a similar experience of life, maybe in phases. So what are the distinctions, would you say, like, were particularly caused by the cult? Because I think when you say drifting and sleep, I know people like that. I guess my question would be like, what's proprietary to being in that environment?
Yeah, good question. I guess what comes up for me around that, Nippy, is that in a cultic group, it's another person or another entity or another doctrine that is actually what is causing the separation from self. You know, it's one thing if you're just kind of a space cadet, you know, and you kind of go through life, or you've had various traumas, you know, for whatever reason, just apathy, you know, there can be lots of reasons that someone can be kind of disconnected. But, you know, when we're in a cultic group, it's this outside force. In an everyday cult, I see it as something that happens really slowly, typically very slowly over time. This gradual erosion of self that is replaced by something else. It's like the ground of me that I kind of stood on for my life was being not only eroded, it was also being replaced by a doctrine.
Let me back up for 1 second for our audience. What did you think you were getting into when you saw all your friends changing and growing? You thought it was a therapeutic-based model using dream analysis. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So it was a personal growth shtick.
Led by a guy we refer to in the book as Doug, but that's not his real name.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. I like that you chose the name Doug because it sounds like...
Because he digs. it was his name. It was just so obvious. His Doug.
Yes, Doug into his belief system.
It's spelled D-U-G.
Yeah, Doug.
Yeah.
Doug.
Tell us about that first moment of being introduced and being excited or elated or falling in love. What did you think you had found that was so exciting?
Oh, gosh. I thought that I had, you know, found somebody that was going to help me with these weird parts of things that I had struggled with. You know, these weird parts of myself that I couldn't fully accept. That I wanted to. I was a seeker. You know, I'd been involved in spiritual stuff my whole adult life and dabbled in many different things. And it was, I think, being a mom, being a new mom, I was more vulnerable. And I really wanted to deal with, I say in my book, you know, I really wanted to deal with the fact that I felt like I'd been sexually abused. And there was no evidence that that had actually occurred. Like nobody had told me that. It was like this thing that happened in my body and in my mind and my psyche from some other therapies that I had done. And I really wanted to kind of get through it. I felt like it was hindering my relationship with my husband and my relationship with the world and my work in the world. I really wanted to kind of get over that shit. And I thought that he might be able to help me. And in that very first session, you know, he did. I felt like he did.
Right.
One of the things I loved about your book and I related to in terms of our experience was that there was clearly good nuggets of therapeutic growth and help that he presented that you used and gleaned in your life. As an outsider reading it, I was also very much aware of the toxic shit that he shoved in on the side. And once you're in and you're all in, you sort of accept it all. And that's where the abuse can happen.
Exactly.
In those early falling in love days, did you ever have some red flags about that? Or were you just all in and accepting it? Or share a little bit about your thought process of when that would happen and how, what you told yourself.
I did not question it. I really didn't. By nature, I'm a really loyal person. So I'm loyal to someone until they kind of prove themselves not worthy. You know, I use in my cult education work, I sometimes use this formula that a wise person once shared with me, what I call the gotcha formula, which is when someone tells you something that is true, someone who you've kind of put a little bit up on a pedestal and you're, you know, appreciating what they've got to offer you, they share something that's true and you say, yeah, yeah, okay, I'm with you. That's great. And then they share something with you that's a little bit true, but you know, it's maybe not 100% true. You know, you're still saying, yeah, yeah, right. Okay. You know, and then they start sharing some more and more stuffs, weaving in some truths, some nuggets. And then you don't notice when they're also weaving in false stuff, you know, and untrustworthy stuff. But all along, like I was that person that all along was just saying, yep, 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 yep. I believe it. I'm naive. You know, I was naive.
When did you know to question?
And how long did that take?
It only took 18 years. Can you believe it? That's all.
No big deal.
Well, you did it. That's the thing.
Yeah, no problem,
that's
right?
That's the story, is that you were able to do it, regardless of how long it took.
Because some people are still in it. So that makes you feel better, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, now I can have an experience where I get triggered by some of the stuff, where I can kind of go into almost like a serious like trauma trigger, like where I've fallen into the manhole again, but I get out quickly now. You know, like I can get out sometimes in as little as a couple minutes. Sometimes it can take a day or two if it's a deep manhole that I've tripped in. But that 18 year shit, I'm done with it because I've lived that. And I really believe that truly is not an option for me and the rest of my life.
Good.
I'm not going there.
And before we get to the wake up, or what you call snapping, can you paint a little bit of the life that you were leading at that time in terms of what did it look like? You know, people are always asking, like, well, what were you doing? Were you just asking questions and wearing sashes? Like, what were you, what did your cult look like? You were going to therapy sessions. You also had retreats, which were very similar to our Vanguard Week, by the way, your farm retreats. When I was reading it, yes. I was like, quick tangent here, and then I'll let you answer the question. I do think it's so important for people in cult recovery to read other people's stories, because I think that it helps you to see the patterns and the templates so clearly. Your words were different, your practices were different, but the processes were all the same, to the point exactly. where I was having ahas as you were sharing your ahas and recognizing just how it works, and feeling more connected to, well, A, to you, but to people who go through stuff like this, even if it's a completely different group.
Right.
So, paints a broader perspective of how the abuses of power just aren't proprietary to these groups. They're everywhere. Hopefully it builds a sensitivity to it, which I think it does, just having more conversations. So
exactly. That's most important to me now in my life, is exactly that, Nippy. You know, and as far as like what my life was like then, do I have to?
No, you don't have to.
It's fine.
Well, I'll tell you what I remember. And I did read the book a while ago, so forgive me. But I remember, like, you had normal jobs, like you created a clean business. And at the same time, then you would show up and like go speak with Doug and have like what seemed like a normal therapy session, except he was analyzing your dreams. Yep. Right. And then there was like a structure, actually similar to Nexium, in terms of becoming a leader and a trainer of the other facilitators, and sort of like becoming closer and closer to being in the almost like an inner circle. Does that sound accurate?
Yes. And part of like being a member of what I call CTL, Center for Transformational Learning, AKA CULT. CTL, which I didn't get it. I didn't make it up that way. It just kind of came out.
Just to clarify, you made it up because you didn't want to use the real name because there's people who are still involved and you're trying to protect them?
I'm not using the real name because I want to avoid anything that could actually distract me from the work that I most want to do,
okay,
which is to help others in the world.
Okay.
And this is such small potatoes. This group is so small. To recognize that Doug and, you know, CTL, quote unquote, air quotes there, were so minuscule in the world of cults even. I mean, they weren't even a good cult, you know, like why bother? Why do something that could potentially distract me through a lawsuit if what I really want to do is help others and, you know, be engaged in this work? So that's the main reason.
Okay.
Yeah. I think he's retired, or at least semi-retired. And they moved out of state.
How old is he?
He's got to be in his early 70s now.
Okay.
Yeah. The other part of my life that was a huge part of the life when I was, you know, especially in those last couple of years, was these emails. We had to be married to our email. We had to read emails that everybody in the group wrote every day where they were basically, it was filled with self-flagellation. So you would take your dream, you would take the work that you were given, you know, your homework that came from the dream that you had to conjure up and apply to everything that you did, and you'd have to write about it. So whenever you screwed up, and of course you only knew that you screwed up when an uplink told you that you had screwed up.
So that's somebody above you?
Yes. The uplinks are the people who were higher in the hierarchy. Either they would tell me or Doug would tell me that I had screwed up. And then I would have to write a long email describing how I had screwed up and how I was going to never do that again. And I mean, these emails, there could be 60 emails in a day.
Wow.
You know, that I was expected to read. And I had to write, you had to write one at bare minimum once a week. Like if you were less than weekly, that was cause for alarm.
What would happen? What would they do to you?
You would get called to task. Oh. Doug would be informed. He would be notified. The next session you go in with Doug, he's like, so what the fuck, Jared? You know, you could have written about so many things, so many different ways that you had screwed up and you didn't do it. So what, you think you're perfect now?
He'd gaslight
to
you.
Berate you.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Did that chap your ass by any chance?
Oh, just a little.
Perfect segue.
Yeah.
What's the thing that chaps your ass the most about Doug or the group?
Oh, well, there was one specific thing. And thinking about today's recording, I was thinking, oh boy, yeah, I'll share that one. I, as we got close to, you know, towards the end there, other people were kind of stepping back from their leadership roles, which I didn't know. Because they were like pissed off and ready to leave. I didn't know that until after. Some of them were leaving. But that made room for the loyalists like me to say, oh, me, I'll sign up for being the support person for an away retreat. Yeah. So I did that for a couple of them. One in particular, the last one, was actually in Ontario. So I was like the support person for this retreat. I sat down with the kind of head of support people for retreats. And she told me, oh, Jared, it's going to be such an honor to, you know, be in this position. You'll get to lay out all the books and you'll get to be the person that people will speak to. And it's so special. It's oh so special. And Doug will take you out to lunch during the lunch break. And it's just amazing. And I'm like, okay. Well, you know, I get there and not only did nobody even want to look at the books that I so carefully laid out, nobody wanted to talk to me about them. And when it was lunchtime, the sucker walked out the door and didn't even look at me. And I'm like, who am I?
He didn't take you out for lunch?
Didn't take me out for lunch, the prick.
Douchebag.
What a douchebag.
You know what? Actually, I'm going to throw in, I have my own chaps my ass about Doug. Okay?
Oh, please.
I do. Because it really bothered me when I was reading your book, how you'd bring him these dreams. And I actually, not as efficiently as you, or I don't have the background, but I like to analyze my dreams and look for meaning, and I find it therapeutic.
Yeah.
On my own, in my own journaling. And you'd present this dream, and Doug would analyze it in this way that was clearly serving his own agenda, that nothing to do with reality, that like you could have interpreted it in the complete opposite way, you know, and
exactly.
based on Jungian philosophy. Sidebar, my mom is studying for her creative writing course and she started using the word animus and anima. And I was like, oh God, don't do that. Mom, it's a cult. She's like, it's not a cult. It's just Jungian philosophy.
It's not.
Like, just don't use those words. But I was triggered based on your experience of Doug gaslighting you with these beautiful concepts and using it towards his own agenda. And I was just, which is ultimately what I see over big picture with both of our groups, is that making you feel like shit, ultimately, like eroding your self-esteem and making you feel less about yourself, A, so that you stay on the path and you keep paying for therapy, which is what I see most of these therapeutic cults doing. They say that they're helping you and dangling your dreams and giving you some results in some areas, but ultimately they keep admonishing you and bringing you down so that you have to keep going on the hamster wheel of development. Is that right?
Exactly. The denigration.
We tell our stories. We change the world. A Little Bit Culty is proud to support the hashtag I Got Out project, which empowers survivors of cultic abuse to share their stories online as a catalyst for education, prevention, and healing. Learn more about the hashtag I Got Out movement and find resources at igotout.org. Did anyone learn a language in high school and then let it go and then have regrets about that later? If you're anything like me, then maybe you'll relate. I did French all the way up into 12th grade, and then I let it go. I mean, I lived in Montreal for a few years and, you know, practiced a bit, but it just slipped away. And then I found Babbel. Babbel is the language learning app that sold more than 10 million subscriptions. And thanks to Babbel's addictively fun and easy little bite-sized language lessons, I've been able to get back my French. I've actually found learning French to be fun again. And c'est vrai, je parle français. With Babbel, you only need 10 minutes to complete a lesson, so you can start having real-life conversations in a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Other language learning apps use AI for their lesson plans, but Babbel lessons were created by over 150 language experts and voiced by real native speakers, not computers. Their teaching method has been scientifically proven to be effective. And with Babbel, you can choose from 14 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, and German. Formidable. That means wonderful in French. Plus, Babbel's speech recognition technology helps you to improve your pronunciation and accent. Clearly still working on that. There are so many ways to learn with Babbel. In addition to lessons, you can access podcasts, games, videos, stories, and even live classes. Plus, it comes with a 20-day money-back guarantee. Start your new language learning journey today with Babbel. Right now, when you purchase a 3-month Babbel subscription, you'll get an additional 3 months for free. That's 6 months for the price of 3. Just go to babbel.com and use promo code CULTY. That's BABBEL.com, code CULTY. Our team at A Little Bit Culty Podcasts loves the Blood Ties podcast because it is gritty and current and fascinating. It's also a little bit culty. Blood Ties, the award-winning audio drama from Wondery, returns for its third season, Strange Days, with another thrilling story about greed, power, and deception. 5 years have passed since Eleanor, played by Julian Jacobs of Community, took over as CEO of the infamous Richland family empire, alongside her half-brother, Santino, played by Christian Navarro of 13 Reasons Why. Together, they decide to invest the family fortune in a groundbreaking, controversial new drug. But as shocking revelations about the new treatment emerge, Eleanor and Santino go to every length to protect their control of the Richland family dynasty. As Eleanor's father always said, medicine is a bloody business. Listen to Blood Ties, Season 3, Strange Days, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or you can binge the whole series now, early and ad-free, by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
Language is such a powerful thing. The way that language is used in cults, I mean, obviously, Robert J. Lifton is someone who we have, those of us in cult recovery, you know, really esteem the eight deadly sins, that list of eight deadly sins of totalist communities that he created. And one of them is loading the language. And what's interesting about CTL, the group that I was in, is they used some of those Jungian terms. You know, and like man, anima and animus are beautiful words. The word that most stuck out for me in the work that I did for so many years was the word pathology. Mm-hmm. I tried to find another word for pathology. There wasn't a substitute.
Can you define what you thought it was?
Well, what I was taught pathology was, is that it is everything in your being that goes against the grain of who you are, who you truly are as an evolved person. Mm-hmm. So for example, if you're a prideful person or a person who gets easily confused or easily distracted, those things, if they were taking you away from your true spiritual path, that would be pathology. Mm-hmm. According to Doug, I was a majorly prideful person.
It's also so weird because I don't experience you that way at all.
Right. Well, I made myself that way for so many years until it was like, you know, when I got out, it was like, pride? I'm I mean, and this will sound really arrogant to say, but in so many ways, I'm actually like the opposite of prideful. Like I tend to be
more humble,
you know, accommodating and humble. Like one of my strengths is that I truly want to hear other people. I extend myself to other people. That's part of just who I am. And I don't make judgments about their experience. But in my cult life, in fact, anything that I said couldn't be trusted because I was probably coming from my prideful, what was called my air quotes, prideful place.
It's such gaslighting because everyone has some aspect of pride at a certain degree. And it comes up in different scenarios. So to say, make an ad hominem attack about one character trait and say it's uniquely yours is punitive at best.
And dehumanizing.
Yeah, it's just gaslighting.
Yeah.
But the loading of the language to me, to your point, is the thing that I'm the single most sensitive to in everything that I read or take in right now. So I'm very like, this experience has really, really got me sensitive to indoctrination and stuff like that. So everything you're talking about resonates.
Well, it's amazing to me how powerful language is, you know, and like in the writing work that I do now, it just is so extraordinary to take in people's words and the words that were used against them, the words that were used to define and control them, and to witness people in their process of recognizing that is one of the most, I mean, it kind of like makes me cry when I think of it, because it has happened, like to watch that language being stripped away. Like what they take on. You use the word dehumanizing, Sarah.
Yeah. So the thought I just had, and I'd forgotten about it till you were saying this about the feedback that you got, because that was the other thing that chapped my ass, was the bullshit feedback that you got throughout your time there, which I totally resonated with. But I think what it is, and tell me if I'm wrong, this is my own projection. I hate to use a NXIVM term, but it is a therapy term as well. When I read your book, I projected that you and I were similar in that we wanted to do good and we're keeners. Like we were both good girls and wanted to get it right, you know,
and do
a good job. And then there's also sort of a certain acknowledgement of that, right? Like looking for the gold star a little bit.
Absolutely. Right? Yes, absolutely.
And I got in trouble for that too, saying, you know, they didn't use the word pride, but it was more about like, I'm controlling the outside world in order to get a result. And that, you know, I'm not okay without, and they'd call it my control issues or whatever, but whatever they name it, it's like, that's a normal thing to look for acknowledgement and to look for approval.
It's also your capacity. It takes your assets, Sarah, and insults your assets, your capacity to get things done, become your control issues.
Yeah. I know that's confusing too. And I think for you too, Jarrett, like you're.
So Jarrett has assets that are being abused and given like.
They use you.
Negative connotations.
Right. Yeah. They use your assets. They use your work ethic. They use your normal desire for approval. And then they say, they take the effects of your work and benefit from it and then make you feel shitty. And for you, they called it pride, which in essence, it's like you are proud of the work that you did and you should be if you did that, right? And they're going, well, now you're being prideful. We can't trust you because you're just doing it out of a place of pride, which is fucking bullshit. That's gaslighting.
It is totally gaslighting and dehumanizing. It's such a mindfuck.
Yeah.
Of course, all of it is. But how it gets twisted, like I feel like one of the greatest traits of a cult leader is their capacity to recognize exactly that, what it is in their members, in their, you know, minions, that makes them, like what it is in you and I that you were just talking, what you were just identifying, Sarah. Like what it is in each of us, for me, it's a kind of loyalty. It's a kind of dedication to good. It's a kind of wanting, a sincere striving in the world. When that is recognized, like a cult leader can just pin that so easily and use it and know exactly how much to give me, how much credit to give me, just little scraps, little snippets now and again. But then mostly to keep me dangling, to keep that carrot out dangling for more, to keep me coming back, to keep me absolutely dependent on his approval.
That's the abuse of it. Yeah, Yanya Lalich, I think, calls that moral injury. They take your morality, your asset, and abuse it, you know, and I think the difference between someone like, say, someone running a company, they see your asset and put you in a position to succeed.
Right.
Right. They're using your assets to build something. They have a vision. The vision for the cult leader is
dependence.
So they identify it and abuse it instead of using it. Yeah. So it's unfortunate. It's abusive.
That was actually one of my favorite lines from your book. The line that you said, that the subtle tension between empowerment and dependence. I love that quote. And I think that's what keeps people, a lot of people in, is that they're getting a certain amount of empowerment, and that overrides and puts blinders on for the fact that you're totally dependent. You can't function. That's why a lot of people fall away when the leader is dead or in prison, because they don't have that same dependent fuel keeping them going.
Yeah, but it doesn't stop all of them. That's for sure.
No, no. As we know,
right. As we well know.
We're not going to talk about that. They could just keep doing what they're doing.
Yeah, exactly.
So we tangented a little bit, but I love our tangents and it's really enlightening. One of the things I loved about your book is how you would share a story and share what you thought was happening in the moment. And then you'd go back to current time and sort of analyze it with these academic and awake eyes. And I think that really provides people with this template of what it looks like in real time, and then helps them go, oh, but that's not what it is, because I know X, Y, and Z now. And right. I think that's a real gift that you give people, because they can now be in their lives and spot those red flags so much sooner than, you know, obviously, like if you and I had had these books, we wouldn't have joined, right?
Exactly. Would have been like, right.
Sorry, what? You're going to charge me what for what?
What did I sign up for?
No, Sorry, Doug.
What's also unique about Jarrett's story, I mean, I think it's kind of to your point, but the destructive part doesn't have to happen for it to become to people's awareness. You don't have to be in the news, right, to learn these lessons, right? If someone can go, they look at our story and go, that would never happen, but they look at something that's a little bit more in their purview and see the symptoms, I think it informs them just that much more, which is a win.
Yeah, and that's exactly what blew me away when I got out, because, you know, I'm like, what the hell happened to me in the, you know, the snapping out and the waking up. It's like, how was I that lost for that long in this thing that looked like, you know, just some classes that you're interested in? Like it wasn't like, you know, I didn't go live out on a plantation far away. And I wasn't in isolation. I wasn't, you know, tithing. There was no tithing. We were paying for legitimate classes, what I thought was legitimate classes and legitimate sessions and all of that stuff. But when I looked at the actual dynamics behind it, it was like, holy shit. That actually reminds me of what's going on in the, you know, the government council in the town next to us. You know, there's actually gaslighting. You know, there's a real abuse of power. There's a hierarchy going on there that is not okay. Or, you know, these small churches, or obviously, you know, kind of laid back versions of business dealings that are not quite like these ginormous multi-level marketing, but there might be like kind of the mom and pop version of multi-level marketing that are using this.
Small-time cults,
exactly.
Yeah.
I know that really motivated you to write the book and be an educator. But before we get to that, can you just share with the audience the moment or the thing that ultimately woke you up that caused you to snap, as you say?
There's a lot to it, you know, and there was a crisis in the organization where six of the kind of top, what I thought were the top sphere next to Doug, all left on the same day. And that was like an massive earthquake and a tsunami all at the same time for this organization. It's like, what? You know, like literally the top people. And we were allowed to have one more meeting, which was the next day. And that meeting was what we called executive committee, which was supposed to be the decision-making body of the organization. And so about 20 of us kind of filed into this room. And in the 24 hours or so between when I heard that all six of them had left and I filed into this room, I had one burning question, which was like, why did they all leave together? Because each person, of course, used the email, which was our form of communication. They all sent their individual emails saying why they left. But nobody said why they were all leaving on the same fucking day. And it's like, what is not being said? And so I just had this like burning question, like, why did they leave all together? We go into this meeting and there's talk happening. Doug did not come to that meeting, which was very unusual. Literally the only executive committee meeting he did not come to. I think he was hoping for a miracle, but what had happened instead was the absolute undoing of the organization. In the last, like literally the last 5 minutes of the meeting, one of the leaders spoke. She is kind of the most humble and quiet of all the leaders. She's someone who had had a lot of trauma in her life and was extremely revered. I felt very close to this teacher. And she described how Doug would berate her again and again and again. And when I heard her describe that, I knew what she was saying was true. Like there was no doubt. It was truth. But that truth didn't match up with the pedestal that I had had Doug on for 18 years. So that moment, there was this like massive rupture of what I now know is cognitive dissonance. I also call that the crack. And that crack is really what freed me, you know, from the grip of this group, of Doug. There were several other things that happened after, but that was like the big one. The fact that Kaylee, I call her Kaylee in my book, was hurt, that Doug would hurt her, was absolutely unconscionable. At that point, I couldn't see that I was being hurt or others were, but the fact that it was Kaylee, and it was my conscience, like my conscience woke up then. My conscience said, whoa, this is not acceptable. I can't do this.
So it was seeing the abuse on someone else.
Yes.
Interesting.
That is interesting.
That's not that uncommon. The number of people that I work with, I couldn't give you a number right now. I'd have to do research, but fairly often people see the abuse in someone they love before they can recognize that they are being hurt as well or have been hurt as well.
Hey there. Hope you're enjoying the episode. Quick reminder to follow us on Instagram. You can also share your favorite episodes with friends who may or may not be in a cult, and also reach out to us to let us know who you would love to hear as a guest. And now, a word from our sponsors. Our team at A Little Bit Culty Podcasts loves the Blood Ties podcast because it is gritty and current and fascinating. It's also a little bit culty. Blood Ties, the award-winning audio drama from Wondery, returns for its third season, Strange Days, with another thrilling story about greed, power, and deception. 5 years have passed since Eleanor, played by Julian Jacobs of Community, took over as CEO of the infamous Richland family empire, alongside her half-brother, Santino, played by Christian Navarro of 13 Reasons Why. Together, they decide to invest the family fortune in a groundbreaking, controversial new drug. But as shocking revelations about the new treatment emerge, Eleanor and Santino go to every length to protect their control of the Richland family dynasty. As Eleanor's father always said, medicine is a bloody business. Listen to Blood Ties, Season 3, Strange Days, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or you can binge the whole series now, early and ad-free, by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
Can I go back to that moment? Because I think that's a fascinating story, how you got to that point. When you got to that point, was it black and white? Or did you then start putting the pieces together? Did you start going, like, start actually looking for experiences that supported that this was an abusive thing? Were you more open to it? Like, because now you're beginning to leave.
Right. Absolutely. It is. It's an extraordinary moment. You know, for me, there was like that big moment and it wasn't conscious thinking at all. It was like, boom, truth, a truth that I had been denying for years and years. And the fact that I had been denying it meant that what I had not seen in other people meant that I wasn't seeing it in myself. For me, there was also like, it was a rupture. It was shocking. It was startling. But there was also this extraordinary sense of relief. Mm-hmm. Like I had been, like there's so much energy that goes into holding on to the lie. Mm-hmm. Like I had been holding on to a lie for years and years and had braced myself. I had made excuses for Doug for years and years for his bad behavior. You know, I always believed every time he yelled at somebody, there was a good reason for it. Every time he yelled at me, there was a good reason for it. But suddenly there was no good reason. And it was like a relief to say, holy shit, that's just wrong. That's just unacceptable human behavior. You don't do that to someone you care about, period.
I wonder if I can get you in front of some people who haven't had that moment yet. I'm always going to that. And it's Nippy's like, you got to get over it.
But you can't facilitate that moment. It's not respectful of where they are. They have to, you know.
They have to sue it for themselves. But I have heard like.
Empathy will get them out. Not shame or anything. You know what I mean?
Yeah. When you said that about, like, I had heard that Alice and Mac, for example, with our story, woke up when she heard about the underage stuff. This is a rumor. I don't know if it's true. That when she heard that Keith was having underage relations with people, and that woke her up and she snapped and she's apparently awake and contrite. And yet there's other people who remain loyal who heard that and go, oh, well, the evidence of that must have been tampered with. And that can't be true, and deny all of those victims' experiences.
Did you go through a lot of that? You're a liar, the character assassination when you tried to leave and all that stuff. Did you have experience of that?
No, I just, good. In fact, it was bizarre. It was just like, oh, I'm gone. Oh, I don't matter anymore. Huh. Okay. I mean, there were some other complications. It wasn't an immediate extrication. I actually was working for them, for Doug. So I had to kind of go through a process to pass over the jobs that I was doing. But the thing about you can't wake somebody else up, what inspires me the most in my work is that question about how does someone wake up? And what I really believe is that we never know when that crack is going to happen. We never know what question or what kind gesture might make that crack happen.
Totally.
So when you were saying, like empathy, love, being, just being human, saying, gosh, how did that make you feel? You know, just stepping in closer, staying in relationship with people who are in, no matter how far they're in. You know, like a term that I wanted to talk about today was a phrase that I've heard you mention a couple times, Nippy, which is willful ignorance. I think it's one that those of us in cult recovery have to look at in a big way, because there are times when people have gotten out and they're not taking responsibility for harm that they've done, you know, and they are, you know, behaving in a way that is continuing to perpetuate harm. That is fucking willful ignorance that I think needs to be called to the mat, you know, when people are being hurt.
For sure.
And the term can also be used in society to describe what all of us did in our tenure in our respective cults. People can say that we were willfully ignorant by doing the stupid things that we did.
I guess what's the delineation?
What's a better way to what's like, what would you say to use instead?
Well, to bring increased understanding of what it is to be living in a kind of a trance state. Like when we're bought in to something, when we have been hoodwinked, we don't have access to our autonomy. So the Jurette that was, you know, in CTL could not see that not only when Doug yelled at Kaylee the way that he did, repeatedly, that she described, but when he did it to me, or when he did it to other members, or when he had all kinds of bizarre, treatments of people, you know, that was just as unconscionable, but I couldn't see it because I was in a trance state. I had created justifications. I had been spoon-fed justifications. And I did eat it. The spoon was given to me. Mm-hmm. I will take responsibility for the fact that, you know, I was a grown adult. I did make choices, and I made choices that led me into something that where I was manipulated slowly, but gradually and very fully. So I think, you know, encouraging in our education process, in schools, in colleges, in community settings, you know, what it is to be in a trance state, what it is to not have access to your full autonomy.
I want to say something about that because I just had to look it up. It is a word that a phrase I've used, but I didn't know the full meaning, or just to relate it to what you're saying. It says, this is on the internet, willful ignorance occurs when individuals realize at some level of consciousness that their beliefs are probably false, but they refuse to attend to that information that would establish their falsity. So what's not good about it, if I'm getting what you're saying accurate, is that if you use that phrase, what you're saying is, well, you knew on some level. And that's not cool because, let's look at this for a second. The truth is that there may be some level of recognition and going, oh, that's not okay. But it's always over, at least for me, this is what it was. It was always overridden with, but the system is good. But there's a belief or an inherent assumption underneath it all that what we're doing is for good and to help people. So if you have something come up that counters that, you can't even wrap your head around it because it conflicts with your base assumption, right? So it's not so much willful ignorance. It's more that there's an overriding belief that you've taken as doctrine that causes you to not be able to see the new belief. Does that sound right?
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, so I think that's like a more kind way of saying, when you say willful ignorance, it's really saying you're an idiot.
Or, you know, you can be saying it as Jarrett was saying, there's ample intel to show that you're denying something that's clearly in reality.
When people use willful ignorance in that way, they're saying, well, you should have known better. Both Nippy and I got that all the time with Nexium, and all the time.
Oh yeah, that's why I think the empathy thing's so important. You know, when we got out and people that were close to us didn't show that and showed more judgment, it's pretty hard. It's a hard thing to, like, I know what it's like to be
judged.
Yeah.
There's a cruelty.
I think what's more helpful for people who are maybe listening and have had that thrown at them in a weaponized way, instead of going like, you know, well, you should have known better, it's like, what was going on for you that caused you to override your awareness of the red flags? Like, I've talked about this in my book too.
Or your sensitivity to them. Yeah.
Like for me, you know, my desire to be a part of this thing and to be liked and to be special was feeling so good, you know? And when I had a red flag of like something wasn't right, like, but no, but this is all so good. So that's like, if you want to look at, if I'm going to take responsibility from that point of view, like what's my human fallibility or my whatever. And I try not to go too much down this path because it reminds me of Nexium, right? Like to go, right?
Exactly.
It gets tricky, yeah. But I have to go, okay, really? Like that's the negative part of it, that I was wanting to fit in, find meaning, find community, feeling special, getting the stripes, like all the stuff that they dangled for me. But it was also that I bought in. I bought in based on trust.
Yeah.
You know, I bought in based on, and we've said this before on other podcasts, Nippy and I and everyone involved, we underestimated everyone's capacity to lie, and we projected our own goodness onto the leadership. That wasn't their goodness. It was our goodness. And that's whether you call that a naivete or idealism, doesn't really matter. I saw good. I wanted to believe good. And when I saw something remotely seen bad or sketchy, I couldn't wrap my head around it because it didn't fit in with what I wanted to see.
Right. Which is cognitive dissonance. Like that's a definition of that kind of, you know, that disconnect. And as humans, we naturally seek understanding. We seek meaning. We seek coherence. And wherever the coherence is not existing, we will compensate. That's actually part of a survival skill. Mm-hmm. So I think there is a way that most of us in cult recovery have lived on some level in a survival mode. It's just part of being human. Mm-hmm. It's just part of our humanness. And I feel like that is what we most need to recover in our recovery process. It's just the fact that, hey, we get to just be human beings.
Yeah.
We get to make mistakes. We get to laugh at ourselves. We get to laugh at our friends. We get to, you know, like do stupid shit and move on. We don't have to pay dues, you know?
That's why I think we're so lucky to have you in the cult recovery world, because you took that pain and those mistakes and whatever you want to call it and made a new path as an educator and author. And then you and I crossed paths with our mutual hashtag.
I got out.
Yeah. Turned a negative into a positive.
Like, that's right. For those of you who don't know, Jarrett is also doing writing workshops where people can write their I got out statement and tell their story and tell us what that's like. What do you get out of that, and how does it feel?
Oh my gosh, Sarah. It's what comes out of the simple structure of the class is so powerful, because people just come with their previous experience of spiritual abuse or, you know, religious abuse or cultic abuse, in whatever way they experienced some form of cultic manipulation. And they're just coming for a little bit of support about how to write their statement. Because what the hashtag I Got Out movement is all about is simply sharing our stories. Like this simplicity of just saying, this is what I've experienced. And in these classes, and there can be anywhere from, you know, 1 to 6 people in these classes. So they're really small. And I used to be offended if there was only one person, because since it's a free class, people don't always show up.
Right.
But I learned very quickly that it doesn't matter. Whoever shows up is meant to be there. So if it's literally one person, it's just as gorgeous as if it's a full class of 6. And like we were talking about earlier, Nippy, with the language, you know, when people can just put a frame to their experience, to their lived experience of cultic manipulation, and just have like a couple paragraphs that describe what they went through, it is exquisitely beautiful. You can feel how meaningful it is, not only for the person who's written it, but for everybody else in the class who get to hear what they have written, and for everybody who then, if the person decides to share it on the igotout.org website, then lots of other people get to see it too. And, you know, the word community can be a really tricky word.
Yeah, we gotta be careful.
Exactly. Because, you know, we all want to belong, and we all, that's what brought us into the damn cult to start with. But in the, you know, the hashtag I got out movement, there is a community that is kind of growing in this organic way, where people choose what to read and what to share. And, you know, there's some amazing connections that are taking place, and it is so incredibly empowering.
Healthy friendships, healthy community. No leadership.
Exactly.
There's no doctrine except tell your story.
Yeah, that's it. Tell your story. Yeah. It's that simple. Yeah.
Which is also a good segue to one of our final questions, which is that, you know, now you have this wealth of knowledge, and I'm sure you get this on almost every interview, is what if people are in a group and they're trying to figure out if it's culty or a cult, or there's abuses of power that aren't healthy, because we're not here to say this is a cult, this is not a cult, where we want people to be able to reflect on their group. And because of this podcast and the books and all the things that we're doing, have the tools to analyze it. So what's on your personal checklist for people to look at their groups?
Yeah, follow the decision-making process. Whatever group you're a part of, take note, how are decisions made and who's making them? And don't take what you first hear for truth. Keep digging, go farther, and also to follow the money flow. Where is money going, and who's making the decisions about how that money is spent? But there's what I call this hidden hierarchy in most cults, certainly in everyday cults. That's one of the kind of really classic parts of it. But yeah, just keep asking. And if it ends up being, oh, there's just one person at the top that's really making the decisions, let that be a red flag, my friends. You know, like there's a lot of wonderful, wonderful groups out there. And don't think that everything's a cult just because it has one or two traits. I recently had somebody come for a consultation and describe this, you know, beautifully complex system, kind of an ashram place. And it was so liberating at the end of it to realize, honey, don't worry about it. This isn't a cult. There's no harm. Nobody's being hurt, you know, and of course, that's the other big thing, is to note who, if people are being harmed. Questioning is actually one of our greatest tools, you know, that we have in our cult recovery, is to question. You know, we have to question. And if that's taken away from us, that actually is stripping away our humanity. Because humanity, you know, when I think of what is it that makes us most human, is you know, we have an openness to other people. We are wired for connection. We are, you know, an interdependent species. And if we want to find out if we trust someone or want to understand somebody else's beliefs, we have to question.
Yeah.
You know, and in that questioning, we actually, I think we are bringing humanity back to the table.
Yes.
The table that was taken away from us.
There's an amendment that protects our right to question.
Exactly.
It's so important.
Right. Right.
So I'm going to read you the last paragraph of the foreword that I wrote for your book. And I said, ultimately, to me, this is not a book about a cult. It's a story of a woman reclaiming her voice, bolstered by a passionate desire to hold out a candle of hope for survivors and other victims of injustice. Truthfully, I didn't want it to be over. I want to hear the rest of her life story as she shares her truth. I'm glad to know her so I can find out what happens next. So what's next for Jurette?
I love that. I love that, Sarah. Your words are just so gorgeous. What's next for Jurette? Well, I tell you, keeping going. You know, I got out is what I'm most passionate about, growing that movement. I do have, you know, a workbook that I'm working on. I've got like three other books that are like starting to kind of take these weird forms in my head. And I'm like, okay, stop now. Take a little bit of a pause. What is next for me is I am going to take a real vacation. I'm going to paddle out into a place that I love very, very much and be out in the woods with my husband, and my daughter will come out for a night.
So I'm going to take a whole week. That sounds divine.
Yeah.
I think also you could have a new business for dream analysis, just for my dreams. Nippy doesn't want to hear about them.
Oh, Sarah, don't ever. Have you been holding back?
Listen, Nippy. Nippy, tell Jurette what your dad said about dreams.
Oh God. Okay, I told Sarah this morning. I remember this happening like twice. You know, in my childhood, it's a vague recollection, but the gist of it was anytime I'd be like, a dream last night, or say, you know, Dad, my dream. He's like, listen, there's two things people never really care about. It's your dreams and your dog.
No.
And that gives you insight.
Your father said that?
Yeah. He's like, they didn't happen. They never will happen. And you can't even really recall the whole thing. Try and remember the dream and tell it in detail. So what's the point? It's just self-indulgent. You're just going to be like... And he's like, and I don't care about
just
your dog
to be clear,
either. Like,
you're not. Just, that's you know. Not our politics. We're not saying anything negative about dogs. Okay. My point is, Jurette, is that I sometimes call my mom because she likes to hear about my dreams. Can I call you too every now and then?
Of course, okay. Of course. I mean, that's the irony, is that you know I still really appreciate my dreams, and I still learn from my dreams. I explore them in a totally different way than what I did for those 18 years. That's the truth of it.
Well, we appreciate you and we appreciate the work that you do and appreciate you taking the time to be on this. And we so appreciate your vulnerability and your openness and everything that you do to educate and shine light on these things. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both so much.
Thank you,
Jurette. The work that you're doing with A Little Bit Culty is just such, such important work. I'm deeply, deeply grateful for everything you two are doing as you're the activists that you are, the educators that you are. We are going to rock this world, you know,
yes,
in this golden age of cult education. We're in it.
She's got such a soothing voice, isn't she?
She's got a voice for radio.
When I read this book, I felt so many times like the character is Doug, right? Doug, who could be any culty therapist that is abusing power. And I'm sure there's many out there as we're saying this, even so much of his pontificating was ripe with word salad. And it made me wonder if you had anything you wanted to say about therapy. Word
salad. Understand. Therapy is a practice that does not incorporate science and measurability and reproducible, quantifiable results. My modality, if you will, subscribes to quantifying, reproducing, and putting terms and measuring your joy. That's the essence of what our curriculum seeks to do and understand. Joy is something that can be measured.
Thank you, Keith. Thank you, Vanguard. Well, everybody, this is just so exciting that we're coming up to the holidays, and we wish you all the happiest of whatever you celebrate.
Are you being diplomatic, like not wanting to say happy holidays, Merry Christmas because of the politically correct assassins out there?
No, I was trying to be inclusive.
Right? Oh.
Happy everything. Happy Hanukkah. Happy.
Can't say anything anymore. It's so bizarre.
Yeah. I just feel like.
You can't live like that. Happy Hanukkah. Merry Christmas. Blah.
Blah. We got Scrooge McDuff over here.
No.
Blah. Blah.
I made it like that. I bet blah to the persecutors.
Yeah, blah to the persecutors. Bah humbug to you, cancelers.
There you go. There you go.
I hope you get some coal in your stocking.
Yeah.
How's that?
Really means.
I'm going to put CBD bath bombs and everyone I love stocking.
I highly recommend CBD bath bombs, even though CBD I'm not sold on yet.
That's because you don't take enough. Mm. Wait, this is an in-house debate about CBD. Okay. Anywho, love you. Goodbye. Sinking down to the depths of the ocean.
Let's keep the conversation going. We'll be back soon with more episodes of A Little Bit Culty with more experts and survivors. And sometimes experts who are survivors, as well as some familiar faces from The Vow from HBO. If you've got suggestions or questions on upcoming topics, find us on Instagram at A Little Bit Culty.
And for more background on what brought me here, my memoir, Scarred, The True Story of How I Escaped Nexium, the Cult That Bound My Life, is available on Amazon, Audible, and where most books are sold.
If you'd like to help us spread the word about A Little Bit Culty podcast, please give us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe.
Seriously, like, take out their phone and tell them to press subscribe. It takes a second. We're also available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and every major listening app. And if you're listening on a smartphone, tap or swipe over the cover art of this podcast to find show notes and helpful resources.
You might also find some offers from our sponsors there. And when you support our sponsors, you help us keep this podcast going. Just don't be a little bit culty about it.
A Little Bit Culty is executive produced by me, your co-host, Sarah Edmondson, and Anthony Nippy Ames.
That's me.
Associate producer is Jess Tardy. Produced, edited, mixed, and mastered by Citizens of Sound. Our amazing theme song, Cultivated, is by John Bryant and co-written by Nigel Asselin. I'm Sarah Edmondson, and thanks for listening to A Little Bit Culty.